Hello, my name is C.R. Powell. I'm an associate professor of urology at the Indiana University School of Medicine. And I'd like to talk for a minute about what CMDA has meant to me. I joined CMDA as a medical student, and that's an interesting time because all of us feel vulnerable, I think, as we begin medical school. I think it's one of those times when we get the rug pulled out from under us to some degree. And so I think for me, having a group of peers that can influence you in a positive way was instrumental. And we encouraged and supported each other during that challenging time. And I think we all need that as people. I'd ask what organizations you're currently involved in and why you want to be involved in those organizations. Chances are you joined those organizations because they are making a positive impact in an area of your profession or an area of interest that you are excited about, in an area that you think is important and an area you value. CMDA impacts medical students. That's all of us at our most junior time. And the medical students are at their most impressionable at that time. We can have a positive impact on somebody for the rest of their career. I can't imagine a more exciting organization to be a part of, especially if it's really wanting to perpetuate the good that we can do as a profession. I'm extremely grateful for what CMDA has introduced me to and for what the organization has done for me. Our local CMDA chapter includes attending physicians. We meet on a regular basis. We encourage one another. We support one another. But the special thing about that is everybody's a physician, and so we're able to understand the unique challenges that other physicians face. And I think that's critical. I think that's something special that most social organizations, and unfortunately even some churches, can't really provide for Christian physicians. My name is C.R. Powell, and that's why CMDA matters to me.
Hi, I'm Dr. Mike Chupp, your host of CMDA Matters, the weekly podcast of the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. And yes, we have finally made it to the last month of this anything but normal year of our Lord 2020. You know, we're most grateful that so many of our members, like Dr. Powell, whom you just heard, they've been faithfully praying for us in leadership during these times of testing that try men's and women's souls. You know, I met Dr. Powell in the late 90s, and I think he was born to be in academics and teaching there at my alma mater, Indiana. He gave a lecture, actually as a fourth-year medical student, that I still remember to this day in our new dedicated teaching classroom there at Temwick Hospital, and I've followed his career. He's making a great impact, loves mentoring and interacting with the students there in Indianapolis. Today on CMDA Matters, my guest is Dr. Mark Regneris, who's a professor of sociology at the University of Texas at Austin. He's also a senior fellow and co-founder of the Austin Institute for the Study of Family and Culture. Our conversation focused on Dr. Regneris' new book, The Future of Christian Marriage. So whether you just jumped on the treadmill or sat down with a fresh cup of coffee, I invite you to listen in on my conversation with Mark, joined by my co-host, Dr. Jeff Barrows. Well, welcome to CMDA Matters today, Dr. Mark Regneris, who is professor of sociology at the University of Texas in Austin. And his research area is in the areas of sexual behavior, family, marriage, and religion. He is the author of 40 published articles and book chapters and 4 books. And the last 2 books, one released this year, The Future of Christian Marriage, which is our focus today. And then in 2017, a book entitled Cheap Sex and the Transformation of Men, Marriage, and Monogamy. And in that book, he described the world as it has come to be due to the influence of technology on sex and sexuality. He is widely read and reviewed, and including The New Yorker, The Atlantic Monthly, Christianity Today, and The Wall Street Journal. And he is a frequent contributor to some things that I like to read, including First Things, National Review, and Public Discourse. Mark, welcome to the program today. Dr. Jeff Barrows and I are delighted to have this conversation with you.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
What was the inspiration for a book this year on the future of marriage after 3 years ago writing about cheap sex?
Yeah, that's a great question. The one kind of directly led to the other, because it's fair to say after finishing Cheap Sex, it's kind of a downer. And I thought, like, let me turn my attention away from sort of Americans' relationships in general. Let me focus on Christians. And then let me sort of see, hey, are there other things going on elsewhere in the world that are comparable to this or perhaps even better than this? So I decided to internationalize it and focus on sort of the marital impulse, because writing Cheap Sex, you've got the impression that people esteemed marriage, kind of generally sort of moved in that direction, but there's so much that sort of blocks the forward progress, sensible progress towards marriage. I thought, well, you know, maybe it's better among Christians and maybe it's better elsewhere. So that was the sort of baseline inspiration for it.
It's a seven-nation tour. And you must have done this pre-COVID, or did you actually enlist the help of a number of other investigators to do a massive number of interviews that you did with singles and couples?
This was all pre-COVID, of course, and I did enlist the help of people. Some of these countries, the sort of English-speaking population is going to be pretty narrow. And I wanted people to speak in their own language. So I had help everywhere. And then I went and followed up in most of those places with interviews, typically sort of re-interviewing somebody whom somebody else had already interviewed. So we talked to people from ages roughly early 20s to about 40. Most of them were unmarried. If they were married, I wanted them to be married maybe 3 years at the most, so they can kind of reflect on that experience of moving towards marriage. Mm-hmm. And everybody's, or at least told us, they were a church-going Christian on average, you know, weekly. However, that didn't turn out to be the case necessarily for some, which at first I thought, well, that's a bummer. But then, it so happened to be like, that's exactly the kind of contrast we need. People who sort of had thought of themselves as Christians but weren't currently active. So that's the population of this book.
Well, there is a theme that is woven throughout the entire book. You come back to it again and again, that today marriage has become, for young people, they approach it as the capstone, as the achievement of having already accomplished a lot in their young adult lives, versus the long-held historic approach of it's a foundation upon which to build. Expand upon that a little bit for our listeners.
Yeah, people think about, like, how has marriage changed over time? And we pose that question to everybody, and almost to a person, they said, yes, marriage has changed. They didn't necessarily name this, but you think about all the sort of the politicization of marriage lately and the structure of marriage, etc. But this thing has been quietly going on, this sort of movement towards capstone and away from foundation, for decades, right? So with the idea of foundation, we're talking about people who marry a little bit younger, early 20s, things like that. Or, I mean, certainly if you're marrying in your late teens, that's definitely a foundation. You should expect to see more marriages in the culture. The emphasis on and foundational marriages is on the practical value of what you can accomplish together. In contrast to sort of what has developed since then is this sort of idea of a capstone. It's not about, like, what you can accomplish together. It's, I become marriageable by having accomplished so many things by myself, right? It's like you're becoming something that somebody will want to marry, right?
It's like a trophy for them.
Symbol. It kind of is, you know, in a sense, like, but it's not like, you know, there's no trophy wife here. It's like you're a trophy husband, a trophy wife. Everybody moves towards attaining the position that will make them attractive. And that, you know, it's a status you build towards rather than sort of the status that you move into in order to help you build towards other things. So that's been a sea change, you know. It's very slow but extremely certain and probably impossible to sort of shift at this point. It doesn't mean that nobody does the foundational marriage anymore. I've been to a few weddings of early 20-somethings lately, but that's unusual. And it's mostly like it's a symbolic thing that you want to attain. And one of the problems is that this makes marriage like an attainment requiring sort of material progress, right? So you think about 50 years ago, who got married more? It was high school graduates and college graduates a little bit less. And now it's just the opposite, right? In part because people, poor and rich alike, see marriage as this thing that they have to earn and attain, right? And when everybody kind of collaborates on this vision of marriage, you know, it becomes sort of reified pretty quickly. You think, oh, okay, maybe it's not this way elsewhere. My goodness, you know, I heard about it in Beirut. You hear about it in Lagos, Warsaw. It's the same. Like, as if the it's not just the media, but like we have been sold a vision, and everybody can see that vision with their eyes online now of marriage as something that's, you know, an attainable good if you work hard and become somebody.
Well, you say that marriage and Christianity, they are tightly linked, and that our faith actually thrives because it organizes and channels human sexual relationships. And because you point out in the book that marriage has a rocky future, I'm assuming then that you're saying that unless we strengthen and bring it back to health, that our faith is in trouble as well. Is that a correct interpretation?
Yeah, I think that's a correct interpretation on a social level, not necessarily on a personal level. I mean, it's a prediction that, you know, marriage and family as a sort of institution has been powerfully supportive of sort of institutional Christianity. So sociologically looking at it like at this, it's like it's not about, you know, whether this person or that person will have a vibrant faith if they don't get married, or if the marriage rates in their community diminish, regardless of whether they're married or not. It's about sort of like the overall health of the institution. And so, I mean, I sort of reflect in the back of the book, especially the last chapter, about what has been lost and what's at risk of being lost in this if marriage continues to recede. Because marriage as an institution, you know, I highlight statistics in the first chapter about, including most of the European countries, you know, people would marry, it's about 90-80% of the population of women below age 30 or up to age 30 were already married in 1980, right? I mean, some of us very clearly remember 1980, and it doesn't seem like a radically different world, although it has become so. Fast forward to the mid-teens, 2014, 15, 16, the last time we had data on this, international data, and those 80 to 90% are now 25, 35, 40%. So it's enough to sort of shake one and think, is it just that we're delaying this, or are we walking away from this? Sure, some people are delaying, and there's not inherently a problem with that. However, when you sort of predict overall marriage rates and you include sort of the delay function as a predictor, like you will get fewer marriages overall, right? So we have to get used to this world in which, including in the Christian world, where just fewer people among us are marrying. Now, some people will push back at me and say, you know, it's not a problem, Mark. I mean, look at the Bible. Like, Paul was privately professing that he wished people were like himself, unmarried. Not to dispute St. Paul, but, I think we're kidding ourselves. And, you are physicians. You see people in their 20s and 30s. We're kidding ourselves if we think an idea of Christian chastity and Christian sexuality is going to thrive when we see sort of a marital impulse wane and shrink. I just think that's not realistic.
Well, Mark, that really leads into a question that I wanted to ask you, and that is, we know that there are several advantages of marriage, and so I wondered if you would kind of go over some of those, including some of the advantages that weigh in on the health side.
The funny thing is, I've been in social science of family for a decade and a half now. And while what's permissible to talk about and to conclude has shifted some, shall we say, the data itself on the sort of benefits of marriage really haven't.
Talk to us about what's permissible and not permissible. You've got both Dr. Barrows and I very curious. You've got a Christian audience listening to you.
What that means? Yeah, so I have written on this subject in ways that not everybody would approve of in terms of sort of same-sex parenting several years back, but also sort of even like if you're criticizing cohabitation, which I do in this book, probably to a level that sort of is shocking to many, because cohabitation, now very normative, it would be so passé to kind of criticize it in the social sciences. So yeah, it's like what gets published, what is appropriate to say in polite sociological company or academic company. Yeah, it's like I try not to sort of wed myself to that because, you know, I'm after what's true, what's real, what's out there. And that hasn't really changed. So marriage in terms of sort of material flourishing is an unmitigated good. You think, oh, you know, it's going to push somebody out of the workforce, probably her, not necessarily. And I make no claim about whether this is, you know, good of that or not. I mean, marriage lends itself to better material flourishing, better psychological flourishing. Men tend to like it better than women, but that's just, you know, that's sort of a stable sex difference in sort of what people expect of their marriages. And then in terms of health, one of the great tragedies of the current era is watching the health, especially of men between ages sort of 45 and 65, the mortality rates start to climb. Some of that, I'd say a healthy chunk of that, no pun intended, is due to sort of the collapse of marriages or the failure of them to form. And men just don't have anybody to look after them, right? I mean, and you might think, oh, why should she be looking after them? Well, that's part of the function of marriage, is that we care for each other. You know, every now and then my wife will ask me, okay, are you going to go get that looked at or something like that? It's like, you know what? Thanks. I should do that. Yes, I'm going to do that, right? Without that, our health recedes. I can think of two men right around early 50s in my orbit, both of whom who are dead today, in part because like their marriages collapsed. No one was around. One of them sort of, you know, had an alcohol problem and died, so far as I can tell, of alcohol poisoning, no one present. And the other one fell off a ladder at home by himself and nobody was there to help him. Like, marriage pays benefits, some of them direct in this case, and some of them, many of them, sort of indirect.
Mark, how can we correct? I mean, you specifically mentioned that it was social scientists who, you know, 20, 30 years ago had the data. You've referred to data, and our listeners, most of our listeners right now to CMDA Matters care a lot about data. In fact, if they get up in front of a crowd of 1,000 within their specialty and make some claim that everybody in the audience knows isn't backed by data, they'll be booed off the stage, if you will.
Right.
So how can we correct this? I know I've had a guest on my program recently, Mr. Abdu Murray, wrote a book called Saving Truth. And we care at CMDA about truth and human flourishing. So how can we recapture this and share data, certainly in a caring way that demonstrates we care about flourishing like physicians, dentists, our healthcare professionals do? How can we talk in a way that is convincing about family and marriage outcomes so that we can win over those who are doubters?
Right. One of the challenges that's going on lately is it's just an explosion in the amount of researchers and publications that are dedicated to sort of what might I call segmented areas of sort of sexual health, sexual identity, that sort of thing. So what we're getting is an explosion in research on sort of micro communities and identities. And yet we have to go back and sort of say, keep your eye on the big picture, right? I think about people like Tyler Vanderweil at Harvard University School of Public Health, Brad Wilcox, University of Virginia. These are people who make sure that we keep our eye on sort of the grand picture of things, right? Yes. Both of them still write on marriage and family and flourishing. in ways that I think are eminently defensible, right? Whereas at the same time, there's, as I said, this explosion in research on this sort of tiny communities, usually comprised of people doing sort of health risky kinds of behaviors, right? And so you can always quote something, but if you're not quoting the big picture stuff, I've always tried to work in the big picture stuff, you're going to get lost in the weeds of stuff. So I think, you know, keep your eye on big picture studies. And it's not enough to sort of just endorse peer-reviewed publications. I've delved lately into sort of dabbling, I guess, around sort of the efficacy of transgender treatments. And, you know, it's, I find that some of the published stuff in some of the big journals, I don't see how they get the conclusion they make. And I don't see how their conclusions reinforce the kind of policy claims they say are derived from those studies. It's just not there. And frankly, it's very frustrating that there's so few of us out there kind of keeping track and tabs on this stuff. So if you're frustrated, you make sure that I am as well.
Be reassured. You know, the book is entitled The Future of Christian Marriage. So if we don't talk about what your predictions are for the future of marriage, I think we'll have missed out on something major. You finish up the book with four predictions. Would you just sort of summarize those for us quickly?
Yeah. So first, I think that marriage among Christians is still going to recede some. It's not like we've hit bottom, okay? Because we tend to follow the wider population norms on this stuff. However, I do think amidst that, you're going to see the resistance of a minority become more visible. And this minority typically is deeply embedded in religious subgroups. I'm not just saying congregations. In fact, congregations on average are too big. Maybe not on average. The ones that the popular congregations, you think, oh, that's where people are drawn to. They don't really function as sort of sources of meeting people. The sources of meeting people are always in smaller kinds of organizations or groups, but they have to be bigger than small group Bible studies, typically speaking. Now, people can meet somebody to marry in a small group, but usually, like, they're so worried about the dynamics of this great group they have that, you know, nobody wants to sort of dabble in asking somebody out. So it's like this medium-term, medium-sized kinds of groups. I think in the Catholic world, there are all sorts of these groups that people are drawn to that are, they're not congregational, but they're sort of, they're local, right? And evangelicals and mainline Protestants have such groups as well. So that's the first kind of prediction I make. The second prediction is a little more sociological. It's about the connection between employment and marriageability. It used to be that was the key predictor of marriageability. And we're just seeing across the board, like, men's marriageability is not enough anymore, obviously, partly because women no longer need to marry at all, right? I mean, they're becoming very successful, et cetera. And so marriageability becomes this much more complicated thing to figure out, right? And so part of the reason why people are sort of seemingly very picky today is because sort of there's just so much more they feel as if they have to consider. There's risk to that, not to say that we want to go back to some sort of a basic, you know, if he can breathe, walk, have a job and not beat you, then fine, he's worth marrying. No, but there is just so many more criteria that people sort of think about, which has this stultifying effect. People never are quite confident, like, oh, is this the right one? What if there's somebody better out there? You know, we live in a world where there's online dating. There's so many options that at least appear before us, and we make them out in our heads to be something that they're not.
And we as Christian parents, I must admit that I, with two young adults getting married this year, one at the beginning of the pandemic and one just before this podcast airs, I think, my wife and I have been a little bit picky for our kids, too. I mean, wanting, of course, success for their marriage.
Right.
And that weighs in on this equation as well, of course.
Oh, my goodness. In fact, parents, and I push a little bit on this in the book, have got to be careful about the advice they offer. It can be well-meaning. It can be accurate. And yet there's this, you know, if I had to say that one of the forces that slow marriages down today is certainly parents trying to sort of second guess their children in terms of either the right person or the timing around this stuff. And I'm not saying that they're going to be wrong or that they're going to be right. It's just, it's a force that kind of contributes to this grand global slowdown of marriage. So, third prediction is that I continue to think that sort of what we call the gender revolution is going to overreach, by which I claim in the book, marriage will never be successfully, sustainably queered, right? Queer being the sort of assault on heteronormativity, for lack of a better word. One of the things I learned throughout the world is that, you know, while the world moves in that general direction, Christians are pretty conventional about marriage. They don't like to rock the boat. They have high expectations for marriage. They're not crazy about sacrificing a whole lot, but, you know, they're pretty conventional. They are pretty good at trade-offs, figuring out like what they can do so that the other can thrive. They want to have children, and they can tacitly endorse other people's unions to some extent, but they really, on average, don't want that for themselves. And I just don't see how this kind of political, cultural move towards trying to queer marriage could ever be successful, because at the heart of marriage is an exchange of sexual difference. And that is just, you know, irremovable from the core of marriage. Mm-hmm. Hence, I make the claim in this book that, you know, cohabitors can sort of, they can make their relationship right. Men and women who are cohabiting can make that licit, right? But we can't really fear sort of this sort of queering of marriage to make it sort of genderless, because at the core of marriage is not something genderless. And frankly, it's not sort of an emotion of love. Although love characterizes marriages, at the core is a man and a woman in a sexual, fertile, or ideally fertile relationship. So I'm not really worried about the sort of diminution or destruction of marriage as between a man and a woman. And not just because of numbers, you know, the population of LGBTQ is small. I mean, it's small but growing. But like, it's still, the core is male and female. And last, I think marriage is slowly but certainly going to become a religious thing. Because who cares most about it? Even though it's receding among Christians, they still care more. Marriage is good for Christians on average. And Christians are good for the institution. Some of it's like a social selectivity idea. Which some of your listeners may know from medical research, like who's more apt to get into something in the first place? Who's more apt to want it? So as we see marriage recede around the world, people and countries and legislatures squabble over the structure of it. You tweak the thing too much and actually it becomes less unique. But Christians still have their eye on like what it is. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And they still want it. I mean, I didn't hear out there people who'd said, I don't want it. They're fine with delaying it for good or ill, but they still wanted it. So I think, you know, the marriage rate will still slow. It'll slow among Christians too, at least for a time. But it's not going to go away. It's not really fundamentally at risk. It's a normal good that Christians still want.
Dr. Regnerus, we wish you the best down there in Austin, and hope we'll get you back on the program again in the future.
Thanks. Appreciate it. Good to talk to you.
Well, whose idea was marriage after all? Well, we as Christians know it was God's idea, as Mark mentions. And so it's been continuously attacked in our modern culture. Yet we know that departures from God's design for love and relationships, well, they've been around since creation. If you're looking for a great marriage resource for yourself or the young adults in your life, an excellent choice is Mingling of Souls, God's Design for Love, Marriage, Sex, and Redemption by Matt Chandler with Jared Wilson. This book explores the Song of Solomon, offering strikingly candid and timeless insights on romance, dating, marriage, and sex. Another book is by author Linda Rooks, who actually was my guest on CMDA Matters earlier this year. And the title of that book is Fighting for Your Marriage While Separated, A Practical Guide for the Brokenhearted. Linda explores practical answers for men and women in the midst of a marriage crisis, guiding them step by step toward hope and a positive outcome, even when fighting for the marriage alone. You can find both of these books and many others at cmda.org/store, or just call and order one of these or both at 888-230-2637. I want to remind you about our first CMDA Live conference for 2021, and that is our Remedy, Bringing the Hope and Healing of Christ to a World in Crisis conference, which will be held virtually on Saturday and Sunday, January 9th and 10th. This conference will feature live speakers and worship from California Baptist University in Riverside, California, from Staten Island in New York City, as well as Memphis, Tennessee, and finally from our headquarters here in Bristol, Tennessee. We will also have reps available to talk with you as attendees if you register live from many different mission agencies, offering both domestic and foreign opportunities. I want to encourage you to tell the undergrads, as well as the healthcare students and residents and other healthcare grads in your sphere of influence about this opportunity. To register, all you have to do is go to cmda.org/remedy and sign up today. Well, I received a special invitation this week from Dr. Peter Saunders, the CEO of ICMDA, our international partner in changing hearts in healthcare, because our CEO Emeritus, Dr. David Stevens, shared this week on the subject of strengthening mission hospitals. And then Dr. Gene Rudd will be speaking on the subject of restoring joy on Thursday, December 17th. These live events start at 9 a.m. Eastern Time, but you can get back to them and view them later on ICMDA YouTube channel. Just go to icmda.net/training/webinars, and you will find a whole host of topics as well as international speakers that ICMDA has recruited this year during the pandemic. Well, it was just last week I was excited to announce a $100,000 matching gift. This gift came just at the right time to challenge all of us to give as generously as possible to help meet our year-end giving goal of $250,000 by the end of December. Perhaps you've never considered a gift beyond your membership dues if you're a member. This would be a great time to give a special gift to help your CMDA. I'm guessing that some of you listening may not realize that only around 11% of CMDA's ministry budget actually comes from dues, while 56% comes from donations. Thank you for prayerfully considering a generous gift to help your CMDA claim all of this $100,000 matching gift and to meet our goal by the end of December. You know, if you need assistance in making any gift, you can just contact a member of our stewardship team by phone at 423-844-1067, or you can just email them using stewardship@cmda.org. I know that many of you are like me, and together we support the work of CMDA in the world because we are passionate about everyone having the opportunity to hear the gospel of Jesus Christ, and that healthcare professionals can be encouraged as they grow in their faith, and that your deeply held Christian values be represented at your state house and on Capitol Hill. Thank you so much today for the many ways that you have partnered with CMDA this year through your prayers, your service to others, and your generous financial support. Together, friends, we are making a difference. Well, today, as we close this podcast, I have a special guest who's going to bring us home with our close, and that's Dr. Brick Lance, who's the chairman of our CMDA Church Commission, which has been working hard in 2020 to provide a biblically-based bioethics curriculum, one that can be facilitated and taught by any Christian healthcare professional in their home church. We are anticipating the availability of this curriculum by our national convention in late April 2021.
I want to share what a pastor taught me a long time ago. His definition of intimacy is, if it matters to you, it matters to me. And if it matters to me, it matters to you. This can apply to any relationship, including a parent-child relationship, marriage, and relationship with God. As a father, I hope all that matters to my child matters to me. I may disagree, but it should matter. I hope what matters to me matters to my child. This is especially true for marriage. We can disagree at times, but we always need to listen. Everything that matters to me does matter to God. He may say no, but it matters to him. I hope all that matters to God will matter to me, that I will cherish the things that matter to God and place them in my heart and mind. Maybe that is why I like your concluding statement of each podcast, because CMDA matters.
Thank you, Dr. Lance. Well, next week, an interview with Dr. Mitch Dunick from In His Image Residency, and he's going to talk with us about the unique challenges of discipling Christian resident physicians in the midst of a terrible pandemic. We'll see you next week, God willing.
This podcast has been a production of the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. The opinions expressed by guests on this podcast are not necessarily endorsed by the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. CMDA is a nonpartisan organization that does not endorse political parties or candidates for public office. The views expressed on this podcast reflect judgments regarding principles and values held by CMDA and its members, and are not intended to imply endorsement of any political party or candidate.